morning. We live in a fallen world. This isn't news to us. It affects every aspect of our lives every day. But there are certain times when the reality of the fall hits home a little harder than others. There was a period of my own life during which the reality of living in a world under a curse skewed my perception of the world. I saw in even the most joyful events the shadow of certain pain ahead. I remember attending the wedding of a great couple, two people who loved God, were crazy about each other, and were clearly enthusiastic about entering into marriage. Everything about it was beautiful. But all I could think was, they don't see the inevitable pain and heartbreak life has in store for them. They're looking forward to a beautiful life, serving God together. They're looking forward to children and grandchildren and getting old together. They don't see the reality of what this fallen world will bring them. Maybe sickness, infertility, or a seriously ill child. They don't see the ways that they'll disappoint or wound each other. They don't see the inevitable deaths of family and friends, and eventually the death of one of them, leaving the other to grieve. I knew that even the most joyful of occasions lay in the shadow of impending pain. I never lost sight of the truth of the coming resurrection. I held fast to the knowledge that the day will come when God will wipe away every tear and make the world right again. But life in the meantime seemed pretty bleak. Fortunately, I've revised my outlook, and the ability to do so came in part through a seemingly unlikely source, the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is typically regarded as a somewhat depressing book, almost existential in his outlook, with its emphasis on the meaninglessness of human endeavor. And there are certainly elements of that. Apart from God, all human accomplishments are meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. I am not going to attempt a full exegesis of the book of Ecclesiastes in one sermon. Such a task would be foolhardy and far beyond my abilities. I do want to share what I believe to be one of the themes that runs through the book. In order to do so, we need to first take a look at a word that's used often in the book, the word translated meaningless or vanity, the Hebrew word hebel. Used 37 times in Ecclesiastes, hebel literally means breath and is often used elsewhere in the Old Testament to refer figuratively to something as fleeting and transitory as breath. The name Abel, Adam and Eve's son whose life was cut short by his brother Cain, comes from the word hebel. Hebel is used in Proverbs 31. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. On the slides this morning, all the italicized words are the word hebel in the original Hebrew. So the word translated fleeting here is hebel, breath. The idea is not that beauty is utterly meaningless. God did create it, after all. The idea is rather that physical beauty is fleeting, here today and gone tomorrow. A woman should anchor her identity not in the rapidly shifting sands of outward beauty, but in God. Hebel is frequently used with a decidedly negative bent, especially when referring to idols, which are so insubstantial and fleeting as to be worthless. In Deuteronomy 32, they made me jealous by what is no God and angered me with their worthless hebel, breath. In Job 27, I will teach you about the power of God. The ways of the Almighty I will not conceal. You have all seen this yourselves. Why then this hebel, meaningless talk? In Psalm 144, Lord, what are human beings that you care for them, mere mortals that you think of them? They are like Hebel. Their days are like a fleeting shadow. In Psalm 39, show me, Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting my life is. You have made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Everyone is but Hebel, even those who seem secure. Considering the range of meanings of Hebel, how should we translate or interpret its use in Ecclesiastes? Is the author declaring life meaningless? Is he commenting on the meaninglessness of life apart from God? Is he using the word in a less negative way, reminding us that life is breath, that it's fleeting? Well, Ecclesiastes is a difficult book. A third century rabbi reported that at one time, some wanted to withdraw the book from the canon because of the apparent contradictions in it. I am far from an expert in Old Testament wisdom literature, and I don't pretend to have solved a puzzle which has proven difficult for centuries of scholars. I would humbly propose, however, that the author of Ecclesiastes uses Hebel in a nuanced way, sometimes pointing out the utter meaninglessness of life apart from God, and sometimes putting an emphasis on the fleeting, transitory, breath-like nature of all human life. This nuanced use of a word is common in literature. A skilled author is well aware of the multiple shades of meaning a particular term can convey, and will often use a term in more than one way for literary effect. Consider one of my favorite plays, Shakespeare's Macbeth. Early in the play, Macbeth is considering whether to murder the good King Duncan in order to usurp the throne. On the one hand, he's eager to grasp for power and is encouraged by his wife to commit a bloody, treasonous act to attain it. On the other hand, he knows full well that there are certainly consequences to be paid for such an act, and he fears that the price is more than he's willing to pay. During these internal deliberations, he says, "If it were done when 'tis done." He means, if only it were over and done with completely, with no consequences to pay once I've committed this act. His first use of done could be defined completely finished with, never to be thought of again. As in, some of my kids thought that after they graduated, they were done with Shakespeare. His second use of done could be defined performed or accomplished, as in, I have done my homework today. Shakespeare was an expert wordsmith, and he made good use of the nuances of the word done in this scene. I think the author of Ecclesiastes has made a similar use of the various shades of meaning of the term Hebel. Consider the following. From Ecclesiastes 1, "Then I said to myself, 'The fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise?' I said to myself, 'This too is meaningless, for the wise like the fool will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die.' So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is Hebel, a chasing after the wind." In this passage, Hebel is clearly used in a negative sense. The speaker hated life because the brevity of it rendered life pointless in his eyes. Or look at this verse from Ecclesiastes 5. "Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is Hebel." Excuse me. Again, Hebel is used to denote something completely vain and useless, the continual, insatiable lust for wealth. So, Hebel is clearly used sometimes to refer to things and pursuits which are utterly meaningless. However, is Hebel always used in such a completely negative way? Consider the following from Ecclesiastes 9. "Go, eat your food with gladness, and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. always be clothed in white, and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this Hebel life that God has given you under the sun, all your Hebel days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the realm of the dead, where you are going, there is neither working, nor planning, nor knowledge, nor wisdom. Is the author really telling us to enjoy our meaningless lives? Or does verse 9 make more sense read, enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this fleeting as breath life that God has given you all under the sun, all your fleeting days? I think maybe this reading makes more sense. Or look at this passage from Ecclesiastes 11. You who are young, be happy while you are young, and let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see, but know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. So then, banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are Hebel. Are youth and vigor really completely meaningless? Or are they fleeting as breath? If they're truly meaningless, why are we exhorted in verse 9 to be happy and take joy in them? How could we rejoice in something pointless? And why should we banish anxiety if we're stuck in a futile existence? Wouldn't facing that fact actually induce anxiety? Does it make more sense that we're being encouraged to enjoy the gifts of youth and health, knowing that they're ours to enjoy for just a short time? I think perhaps the author wants his reader to contemplate life's brevity and live his life accordingly, not in despair, but enjoying good things while they last. A similar idea is expressed in Psalm 90, in which the psalmist contrasts God's eternal nature with man's temporal one. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the whole world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn people back to dust, saying, return to dust, you mortals. 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. Yet you sweep people away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. In the morning it springs up new, but by evening it is dry and withered. Our days may come to 70 years, or 80 if our strength endures. Yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. What's the value of dwelling on man's mortality and the brevity of our lives? Well, verse 12 tells us, teach us to number our days, that we might gain a heart of wisdom. Keeping in mind the brevity of our lives helps us to make the most of the days we do have, to live them wisely. I believe this is one theme found in Ecclesiastes. Remember that our days on this earth are few. They're fleeting as breath, and live them well to the glory of the Creator. This theme is supported by the substantial portion of the book that consists of Proverbs instructing us how to live well. We're exhorted to be patient, not quickly provoked to anger, to avoid the temptations of immoral women, to be wise in our interactions with the authorities, not to be lazy along with others. In addition to these very practical moral directives, we're exhorted to do something which seems very strange in a book that reminds us so often of our impending demise. Several passages actually command us to enjoy life. Let's take a look at these. From chapter 2, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? From chapter 3, I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. 3:22, So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? From chapter 5, behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. From chapter 8, and I commend joy, for man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful. For this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. 11:9, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Notice in these passages, these are the same verses, just certain sections in red. Notice in these passages that the ability to enjoy the things of life is repeatedly called a gift of God, from the hand of God, a gift of God. God has given him. God has given him. We looked at this passage earlier, but this time notice the directives to be joyful. Go, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. This passage is especially interesting when we compare it to a passage from another ancient text, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Another thing my kids thought they'd be done with when they graduated. In this work, Gilgamesh is a king who goes in search of everlasting life after the death of his closest friend. Along the way, a goddess tells him, Gilgamesh, where are you hurrying to? You will never find that life for which you're looking, eternal life. When the gods created man, they allotted to him death, but life they retained in their own keeping. Only the gods get eternal life, and that's how it's supposed to be. As for you, Gilgamesh, fill your belly with good things. Day and night, night and day, dance and be merry, feast and rejoice. Let your clothes be fresh, bathe yourself in water, cherish the little child that holds your hand, and make your wife happy in your embrace, for this too is the lot of man. The directives in both Ecclesiastes and Gilgamesh are similar. Eat, rejoice, clothe yourself well, enjoy life with your wife. But there's a significant difference. Gilgamesh is told to eat, drink, and be merry in spite of the god's ill will. The story elsewhere actually includes an account in which the gods send a worldwide flood to destroy humanity. Why? They're annoyed by the racket man makes. Men are noisy and they're irritated, so they wipe him out. In the world of Gilgamesh, man should seize the day because that's all he has. In Ecclesiastes, however, we're free to enjoy life because God favors it. He has not withheld good gifts, but has granted us these things, and we therefore please him when we rejoice in them. Conversely, in chapter 6, despair is actually caused by the failure to take pleasure in life. A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but fails to enjoy his prosperity. There's actually a theme of joy that runs through this book. We are to enjoy life, keeping in mind that it's as fleeting as breath and that we're accountable to God for the way we live it. Ironically, keeping the brevity of life firmly in view can actually help us to take joy in good times. I remember sitting in my living room one day a few years ago and looking around me at the perfectly normal, everyday things going on around me. Eric was working, I was reading to kids, helping with math, biology. The kids were doing things normal, healthy kids do, which of course included needling each other. It was just a perfectly normal, unremarkable day, full of perfectly normal, unremarkable events. I sat on my sofa and just soaked it all in. I rejoiced in it, savored it, because I knew everything around me was fleeting. It could all disappear with one phone call or one blood test. Even if nothing went catastrophically wrong, none of it would last forever. So I took joy in the people and the good things around me while I could. The knowledge that they were fleeting and transitory allowed me to enjoy them more fully while I had them. So how should we live in light of the wisdom of Ecclesiastes? How do we respond to the frequent reminders that we're as a vapor and yet we're to take joy in life? First, if God is sovereign over the past, present, and future, we are free to enjoy the good gifts he bestows on us now, however temporary they may be. To enjoy them is actually to do his will. Food on the table, the love of family, the sun in the sky, friends, functioning or mostly functioning bodies, youth, shelters that for most of us are far more than adequate. All these things are gracious gifts given to us to be enjoyed with thanksgiving for as long as we have them. We haven't earned them. We don't deserve them. But God in his gracious goodness has bestowed them on us. To enjoy them is actually to do his will. Second, we should be content now with our place in God's good creation. Our inclination, or at least mine, is to be continually looking back nostalgically at former days or anticipating some future time when we'll finally have what we need to be happy. But Ecclesiastes 7:10 tells us, "Do not say, 'Why were the old days better than these?' For it is not wise to ask such questions." We cannot live a life overflowing with thankfulness to God for our present blessings if we're constantly obsessed with those no longer in our possession. This is not to say that we shouldn't mourn the loss of good things, but we shouldn't let those losses consume us. Similarly, to believe that we'll be happy at some future point when our circumstances will finally be more to our liking is to fail to appreciate the good things that God has given us now. Third, we ought to view work and the ability to do it as a gift, not merely a necessary evil or a diversion from the harsh reality of life's brevity. As numerous passages in Ecclesiastes tell us, and as Wendell pointed out a few weeks ago, work is a good thing. It was part of God's original perfect creation. Granted, the fall has made work more burdensome, but it is still fundamentally good. The ability to work is a demonstration of God's kindness, and the choice to use that ability and to work hard is one way that we honor and obey him. If you've ever been ill or unable to work temporarily, do you remember how it felt when you recovered to be able to accomplish even the most mundane tasks? Suddenly, washing the dishes or doing the laundry or going to the office seem like luxuries to be savored. Jobs that you once dreaded, you now give thanks for simply because you no longer take for granted the ability to do them. Well, the time is coming for each and every one of us that we will no longer have the opportunity to work. If we are granted the luxury of growing old, Ecclesiastes 12 will likely become an accurate description of us. Unless Christ returns first, every one of us will die. And as chapter 9 points out, there is no work for us in the grave. Now, living in light of the New Testament, we know that this gift will be restored to us at the resurrection, but we'll lose it for a time. I fail at this regularly. But each day that I am able to cook a meal or plan a lesson or sweep the floor or scrub the church restrooms ought to be a day on which I thank God for the ability to do so.
Nicely said.
Yes. Lastly, while everything around us will one day be gone, everything around us is hebel, breath, There is something, or rather someone, who endures forever. It is not meaningless or futile to live a life of obedience which glorifies our eternal Creator. I'm happy to say I no longer see joyous occasions as mere preludes to pain. I now see a new marriage as a gift of God to be celebrated no matter what the future holds. I see the birth of a baby or the graduation of a child or something as everyday as a picnic in the park in the same light. We serve a good God who, in spite of the ruinous effects of the fall, showers us with good gifts to be enjoyed. This is true even more so in light of the truth revealed in the New Testament. This life is fleeting as breath. But at the resurrection, all will be restored. Everything will be set right. And we will be free to enjoy God's good gifts, not for a brief season, but for all eternity. Remember, we're as a vapor, God is eternal. Whatever difficulties and enigmas the book of Ecclesiastes may contain, the conclusion is clear. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And on that note, I believe John is going to come close us.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Wow, thank you, Carrie. If you're like me, I am anxious to get my Bible out and go back through Ecclesiastes and study that whole book in light of what you just shared. Excellent words. If you'll stand, I'll close.